Welcome to What I Tell My Patients, a program for oncology nurses on the management of urothelial bladder cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. As a follow-up to our recent live symposia at the 2023 Oncology Nursing Society Annual Congress, I met with Dr. Elizabeth Betsy Plimick from the Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia. To begin, I asked Dr. Plimick to provide a basic overview of the presentation and the goals of care for patients with urothelial bladder cancer.
When we teach our fellows in clinic about bladder cancer, we always emphasize that most bladder cancer is cured. Most of it is early stage, treated with intravesical approaches to the bladder. There's a lot of very exciting work going on there that's increasing our cure fraction sort of this non-muscle invasive bladder cancer entity. And so a diagnosis of bladder cancer does not mean that it will spread or that surgery or chemotherapy is required.
You mentioned muscle invasive, non-muscle invasive. Could you talk a little bit about how bladder cancer starts and kind of what the difference is between muscle invasive and non-muscle invasive?
Right, exactly. So bladder cancer starts in the lining of the bladder. We call all urothelial cancer, we kind of bucket it as bladder cancer, but really it can occur anywhere in the urothelium, including the tubes connecting the kidney to the bladder and the urethra connecting the bladder to where the urine voids. So any cancer arising in that lining is urothelial cancer and is conceived of in the same way and treated relatively similarly. Cancer that is content to stay on the surface lining of the bladder is called non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, and that, again, is easy to treat with treatments that go into the bladder. Once the cancer has demonstrated that it has dug into the muscle layer, the outer more layers of the bladder, and this is diagnosed on biopsy done by going in through the urethra to take a piece of the tumor and the muscle underneath. Once it's demonstrated it can do that, we address it differently. We know its biology is different. We know it likes to spread. We know if left unchecked, that's exactly what it will do. And so for muscle invasive bladder cancer that has not apparently spread anywhere else, we treat with chemotherapy followed by usually surgical resection and lymph node dissection.
So let's talk a little bit more about non-muscle invasive disease. How do these patients typically present? What kind of diagnostic process do they go through? And then what kind of therapy do they receive?
Great question. So the most common presenting symptom of bladder cancer or any urothelial cancer is blood in the urine. Often the patient notices this and brings it to medical attention. Other times it's caught on screening in the primary care doctor's office, but that's almost always the presenting symptom. And I think we're lucky that bladder cancer can declare itself that way relatively early. Once the blood is in the urine, the workup includes imaging as well as look in the bladder, cystoscopy. If a tumor is noted, then the patient is booked for an operating room in a TURBT, transurethral resection of bladder tumor. It's a little bit misnamed. It's really more of a biopsy where they take a piece of the tumor and the muscle underneath. Sometimes they take everything they can see. Sometimes there's too much and they take a little bit. But the pathology from that procedure is diagnostic. If the muscle is not involved, then treatments can be intravesical, and we can talk about what those look like today and what they may look like in the future. If it is into the muscle, as we said, it's chemotherapy followed by surgery. Those treatments are evolving as well.
So again, continuing with the non-muscle invasive situation, what are the usual first therapies that are used?
So for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, and again, this is managed by the urologist, so our urology colleagues could speak closer to this, but generally we start with BCG. BCG is really an immunotherapeutic. We're not exactly sure how it works, but it's been used for a long time. Patients get an induction and then maintenance course, and then they're followed with looks in the bladder, cystoscopy, and TURBT to get pathology to make sure that the bladder cancer is gone. If that's not enough, doesn't work, or isn't tolerated by the patient, there are additional treatments. We're looking at clinical trials of intravesical chemotherapy. There is systemic immunotherapy, which has fallen somewhat out of favor. And then there are new novel drug delivery devices looking at delivering chemotherapy and instilling it and keeping it in the bladder. So those are all things that we're looking at. Always, however, I should say, removing the bladder is curative of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. We just try very hard to cure it without having to remove the bladder.
And you mentioned the use of immunotherapy. Can you talk a little bit more about in what situations that's used and how it's used?
So one of the key sort of tenets of thinking about muscle-invasive bladder or non-muscle-invasive bladder cancer, I should say, is that we know we can always cure the patient by removing the bladder and lymph nodes. It's very rare that one of those tumors can escape beyond the wall of the bladder if it doesn't show up on biopsy. So really, the bar for any treatment has to be cure, since we know we can achieve that surgically. So non-surgical cure is the goal of any treatment. BCG can cure. The systemic immunotherapy, pembrolizumab, was one that was tested in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. You know, the outcomes are measured in terms of complete response rate at a certain amount of time. The follow-up, we have not seen extended follow-up beyond a few years for people. And it's looking like the percent of patients who are confirmed to be tumor-free with intravenous pembrolizumab is around 10% or maybe even less. And so once we get there, coupled with the cost and side effects of the treatment, I think it's fallen a little bit out of favor, and we're looking more keenly at novel intravesical therapies to kind of get patients to a non-surgical cure.
So one novel approach that I'm curious what your thoughts are is the so-called TAR 200 device. I've heard it called the pretzel. Can you explain kind of what that is and what you think the future might be of this kind of approach?
Yeah, so we're pretty excited about it. I mean, it's definitely novel. Someone showed it to me at a meeting. It fits in the palm of your hand. It's a sort of drug-eluting device that folds, you know, it can be a long, thin stretch as it goes into the bladder, and then it folds itself into literally the shape of a pretzel once it's there, and it can elute drug. They're testing different drugs in this device to see how well it works. But early data so far, trials ongoing, we'll see. It would be great if this worked because it's relatively easy to place, relatively easy to remove, but can potentially provide treatment over a longer period of time given that it elutes.
So you referred to something that really is a very, very key issue in urothelial bladder cancer, which is the surgical procedure of cystectomy. Mm-hmm. In this situation, you were talking about it as being potentially curative for non-muscle invasive. We'll talk about it for muscle invasive. But one of the problems here is that a lot of these cancers occur in older people, and in some, this procedure is a real challenge. Can you talk a little bit about what patients go through who receive a cystectomy? And in what situations do you hold back on doing a cystectomy because of the patient's, you know, comorbidities or age?
Sure. So again, I am not a surgeon. I'm fortunate to practice with an amazing surgical team that, you know, age is just a number to them. They really look carefully at the patient, their comorbidities, the risk factors, cardiac workup, pre-op testing to decide, you know, where to safely proceed with cystectomy, and I should say cystoprostatectomy in men and cystectomy with anterior exenteration in women. It's quite an extensive procedure, as you said. I think at an experienced center that does a lot of these, they can really safely get most folks through the procedure, barring significant comorbidities. I think it's harder to do at centers that don't do it as often. It's just one of those surgeries you want to have done at a specialized center. But age per se does not factor in. All of the things that come with aging in terms of health and the resilience of the body do come into play and are measured beforehand.
What do you and your team see once people get through the procedure? Obviously, as you said, it is a big procedure, so just sort of getting through it is the first step. But in the longer run, what are some of the things that people have to adjust to?
So when someone's bladder is removed, the urine has to be diverted in a different fashion. And there are a variety of what are called continent diversions. The most common is an ileal conduit where there's a bag affixed to the abdomen and the urine is routed out through a stoma in the abdominal wall. I would say the patient perceptions of what life will be like with an ileal conduit and ostomy are generally worse than their ultimate experience of it afterwards. And we try to really help patients who are facing cystectomy understand what their diversion will look like, what the pros and cons are. The Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network has a great series of videos of patients talking about their own experiences. We have a patient-to-patient network here, and others do too, where you can speak to people. But the lived experience of life after bladder removal can vary person to person, but is generally better than anticipated, is what I would say. The other benefit is a lot of these folks have struggled with urinary symptoms, irritative voiding, being up all night to use the bathroom, and those go away when the bladder is removed. So I've had more than a few patients say they're really happy to be be rid of it and that it's opened up their life to sort of more flexibility and possibilities.
How long in your experience do you see that it takes people to sort of recover just from the surgery itself?
So I'm not intimately involved in their surgical recovery. By their first scan at 3 months, they're looking pretty good. So generally, I think, you know, low expectations of what you're going to be able to do during that time. But there's also, of course, work one can do to recover prehab and rehab from surgery, which generally involves being active, staying hydrated, all those things.
So let's talk about muscle invasive disease. And first, though, we'll talk about localized disease, both in patients who are candidates for cystectomy or not. So first, let's talk about theoretically a younger patient in pretty good condition who would be a candidate for cystectomy. Again, how are they typically diagnosed? How are they usually managed? And particularly, how do you decide whether to give them chemotherapy, neoadjuvant chemotherapy, before the surgery?
So we're talking about muscle-invasive bladder cancer. Again, they usually do still present either with non-muscle-invasive bladder cancer that progresses to muscle-invasive, or more commonly just with the blood in the urine and the workup at their initial diagnosis is found to be muscle-invasive. The first part of the workup is imaging to make sure it hasn't spread anywhere else. And if we don't see that it's spread, we then proceed with a plan for cure. We always recommend neoadjuvant chemotherapy for any patient who is cisplatin candidate. And we measure that, you know, here slightly different maybe than other places, but generally it requires a good creatinine clearance, a good performance status, and lack of a major comorbidity like heart failure. There are some softer indications like hearing loss or neuropathy, but really with the amount of chemo we give, we sometimes discount those as reasons to make someone ineligible for cisplatin. If they're eligible for cisplatin, we then proceed with chemotherapy ahead of surgery. We know this helps provide an overall survival benefit to patients. They live longer. The cure fraction is about 10% higher when we give the chemotherapy beforehand. And we're not usually successful about getting it promptly into patients after they've been through a big surgery. That looks not the best time to give them chemotherapy. It's easier to recover quickly from chemotherapy and proceed to surgery than the other way around.
That's interesting. So do you think the reason that it is more effective is just that you're getting it in before they have the surgery when they have a lot more difficulty handling it?
That's part of it. We get it to more people. And if you think about it, it's really treating micrometastatic disease. So the sooner you do that, the better. It's also enabling a more successful surgery. So you're kind of shrinking the tumor up. I think the surgeons appreciate having less to take out when they go in there. And so those are the two advantages.
So I know it probably depends a lot on how big the tumor is and the stage, et cetera, but roughly when you do neoadjuvant therapy, how often do you see that the patient has a pathologic complete response? You go to surgery and there's no tumor there.
Yeah, that's a great question. So with modern cisplatin-based chemotherapy, and the numbers are a little higher for docetaxel and bec than for gem-cis, as demonstrated in randomized trials. But typically, it's about 40% of patients will have new tumor in the bladder when we go in. An additional 10 to 20% perhaps are downstaged, where the only tumor that you see is non-muscle invasive at the time of surgery.
So when you think about those groups, what's the long-term prognosis in terms of recurrence, for example, for a path CR versus residual disease?
Patients with pathologic CR do much better in terms of overall survival, as expected. They've responded to chemotherapy. The tumor was eradicated from the bladder, so most likely anywhere else it had spread. And so the overall survival rate for that group is really quite high, and they can actually be surveilled a little less frequently. If they have residual disease after neoadjuvant chemotherapy, it's a little bit less. In the balance for all comers, I would say I think we're looking at like 80%. Metastasis-free survival at 2 years and sort of, you know, patients die of other things. Sometimes with bladder cancer, that's still a cure, but cancer-specific survival sort of falls from there.
When you do see recurrence after this primary surgery, when does it typically occur?
Within the first 2 years. So we tell patients who are in surveillance, every scan that looks good increases their chance of the next scan looking good. It's sort of just statistics that build upon each other. But at the two-year mark, we generally tell patients it's very unlikely that you'll have a recurrence of the cancer we just treated you for. But a key thing to keep in mind is the urothelium is still prone to growing new cancers. And urothelial cancer is what we call the field effect, where If you get cancer in the bladder, you're prone to get it in the rest of your urothelium over time. And this is one reason why very young patients, even though they may be most motivated to keep their bladder potentially, it's a little bit dangerous to keep urothelium in those patients because they have a longer time for new primaries to grow and they are at risk for those. Doesn't mean we can't address them and treat them, but removing the bladder decreases the urothelium percent, the amount that's in the body that's at risk.
Yeah, that's a great point. I was going to ask you in the beginning, but I'll bring it up now, the connection between smoking and urothelial bladder cancer. People obviously think about head and neck cancer and lung cancer, but there also is a correlation with bladder cancer. What kinds of patients do you typically see? Do you see a lot of people with chronic obstructive lung disease and tobacco-related morbidities, or is it more just something you see epidemiologically, a correlation, or are these people heavy smokers?
So it really runs the gamut. And one thing, I'm glad you brought this up, Neil. The Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, are really trying to sort of dispel the stereotype that bladder cancer patients are old, sick, frail, heavy smokers, debilitated with emphysema. And the reason we sort of want to do that is because it's really been perpetuated. You know, I think there are talks where people say, you know, bladder cancer patients are old, they're frail. You know, they're no more old or frail than our lung cancer patients or head and neck cancer patients. And we go at those diseases aggressively as well. So I think for some reason, bladder cancer patients have gotten this reputation, but truthfully, it's everybody. You don't have to smoke to get bladder cancer. It can be a random event. Most of our patients have smoking somewhere in their history, but many of them quit years ago. So the sort of comorbidity rate with lung disease, it's there. It's relatively low. I would say it's, you know, there for every kind of cancer that hits humans who have a range of comorbidities. So I hesitate to generalize that that's a true statement about bladder cancer patients. I hope we look at each patient individually, their overall health and their issues when making treatment decisions and when sort of assessing them in terms of frailty. I'll also say there are frailty, you know, measurement tools, and there's a whole NCCN guidelines for older patients with cancer. So we have a lot of tools we can use to individualize treatment for our patients across the age spectrum.
That's a really great point. Getting back to the better conditioned patient who gets neoadjuvant therapy, goes to cystectomy, one of the most important developments that occurred in the field now has been the use of adjuvant immunotherapy checkpoint inhibitors. We've seen this come into lung cancer, and it's also in bladder cancer. Can you talk about the study that was done, the main study that was done that led to the use of this therapy, but also other studies that were done? There was one in particular that wasn't positive, and how you and other docs go about deciding whether or not to use this therapy.
Right. That's a great point. So just a broad statement about adjuvant immunotherapy. So we know immunotherapy is a game changer in the treatment of metastatic disease across some of the diseases you mentioned: head and neck, lung cancer, melanoma, kidney cancer, as well as urothelial cancer. What's fascinating to those of us in the field is there have been many, many, many adjuvant trials of various immunotherapeutic approaches, and none have shown an overall survival benefit yet. So even the melanoma study, which is in its sixth year of follow-up, you know, we're all hypothesizing few events. Maybe people are just doing really well in general. Maybe they're doing well with subsequent therapy. We won't know until the data are released. But we're even behind there in urothelial and bladder cancer. So just to keep in mind, the goal of adjuvant therapy is to increase the percent of patients we cure. I think few people would think that adjuvant is worthwhile just to delay recurrence. We want to prevent recurrence. And to show we're doing that, we're going to have to show an overall survival benefit, which we haven't yet. I can speak specifically to the urothelial studies now, if you like, but I think that's an overarching sort of way of thinking about adjuvant immunotherapy studies for the time being. The second the first one reads out positive for OS, we'll all rejoice across disease sites.
So can you talk about actually what was studied, what was seen, and now how people are utilizing this treatment?
Right. So adjuvant trials so far, we've seen nivolumab, which was tested in a randomized phase 3 trial, a year of treatment versus placebo, I believe. And that showed a relapse-free survival benefit, meaning more people relapsed at various time points in the group that got placebo than the group that got treatment. We have yet to see an overall survival benefit for that drug, but it's FDA approved, and we do discuss it as a standard of care with patients in the adjuvant setting. A similar trial was done with atezolizumab that was a negative study. There was no relapse-free survival benefit and no overall survival benefit. Those curves were really overlapping. But one of the very interesting analyses done on that was a cell-free DNA, circulating tumor DNA study, looking to see if patients could be identified who are prone to recurrence. And some of those data, while sort of retrospective in nature, indicate that it was the patients with circulating tumor DNA, that cell-free DNA, that got the most benefit from treatment. And so maybe the answer, Neil, is going to be patient selection, which from my perspective would be great. I think for adjuvant therapy in general, we know we overtreat. All the people who are already cured with surgery, we're overtreating them. We really want to direct these adjuvant therapies on people destined to recur and try to prevent that from happening.
And we're really seeing, particularly in colon cancer, cell-free DNA really utilized in making decisions. I don't think it's really going too far beyond that, but it's being looked at certainly in a lot of cancers, including bladder cancer. We'll talk about the use of immunotherapy later also, but now might be a good time just to bring up some of the toxicity issues that come up. We talked about immunotherapy for non-muscle invasive. Now we're talking about in the adjuvant setting for muscle invasive with nivolumab as opposed to pembrolizumab. But in general, what are the common autoimmune toxicities that you see with these drugs?
So we've gotten a lot of experience with these drugs, and I think the community oncologist and the oncology nurse probably knows these very well just because they're used so ubiquitously across various cancers. So that's the advantage. At the beginning, when we were just trying these for the first time, it was a really steep learning curve for all of us. But the most common things we worry about that are non-threatening but common are itchiness or pruritus that can go with rash or not. We see thyroid and adrenal function affected. We treat that with replacement therapy and then continue the immune checkpoint inhibitor. More severe autoimmune reactions that we can see, but that are sort of in the common category, are pneumonitis or inflammation of the lungs, hepatitis, where the liver enzymes bump, and colitis, where there's profuse sudden onset diarrhea. The interesting thing, important thing to know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know already, is that unlike prior treatments with immune checkpoint inhibitor, if you hit a bad adverse event, holding therapy is not enough to reverse it. So the toxicity will continue unless it's counteracted with steroids. And there are different ways to give steroids. We give them in different scenarios, but it's not something that goes away just by stopping the drug.
So we kind of talked about the route that a patient in good condition who's eligible to get cystectomy would take. What about the older patient, perhaps a patient who's not eligible to get cystectomy? Or also, you talked about eligibility for cisplatin, who's not eligible to get cisplatin. What kind of route can they take?
So that's a great question. So we found here at Fox Chase that generally folks are either eligible for cisplatin and surgery or ineligible for both cisplatin and surgery. And the in-between, ineligible for cisplatin but eligible for surgery, is a very narrow group. That's just what we found. We've tried to do trials in that group, and sometimes we can do it, but not always. So the alternative for those folks is to do, we don't have a neoadjuvant chemotherapy yet established for those who are cisplatin ineligible. We are looking at immunotherapy, you know, and fordamab vedotin with pembrolizumab. We're looking at all those things, but nothing's there quite yet. So those folks, we tend to recommend chemo radiation for muscle invasive bladder cancer that's at the lower end of the stage spectrum. So no extravesical extension typically, no nodal involvement typically, but patients who are muscle invasive, you know, stage two, for instance, we give a low dose of chemotherapy to sensitize the tumor in the bladder to the radiation that's given typically every business day over a 6-week period.
And is this a curative therapy from your point of view?
So yes, it is curative. And in fact, there was a large meta-analysis done and presented at GU ASCO last year or this year, I lose track, that really tried to show what the difference might be between the two. And it seems that there's a really nice cure fraction with radiation with chemotherapy. There was a randomized trial looking at radiation with chemotherapy versus without, and that showed a benefit to giving it with. But really, the sort of cure percent is what we're interested in, and it can be equivalent. Now, the drawback of radiation is that the bladder is still intact in the body. It's been radiated, and, you know, the patient is prone to new cancers growing. In an older patient, that's less of a concern than in a much younger patient. Of course, they have less time, you know, lifespan ahead of them statistically in order, you know, for new cancers to grow. But that's one of the drawbacks. The other is, you know, symptoms. I told you some patients are delighted to have their bladder removed and drain their urine elsewhere because they had so many symptoms from the dysfunctional bladder. There's a slight increased risk of that with radiation. So patients are monitored for that and counseled around that.
Now, we talked a little bit about the use of immunotherapy in the patient who gets a cystectomy to try to prevent further recurrence. What about the use of immunotherapy in these patients who are not getting cystectomy, the chemo radiation? Do we know anything about that?
We're studying it. We're studying immunotherapy, both neoadjuvant prior to chemo radiation, concurrent with the radiation. I'm not aware of adjuvant studies, although I'm sure they're out there. But right now, no, there's no role for immune therapy in those patients until or unless they develop metastases.
So maybe we can move on and start to talk about metastatic disease. But somewhere along the line, and I think this might be a good time, we have to ask the question of the day. We just went at ASCO, we did like 9 programs, and every single one of them, the issue of chemotherapy shortage came up.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about sort of how that's affecting the management of urothelial bladder cancer, particularly the shortage of both cisplatinum and carbo? I know it's sort of different in different parts of the country.
Yeah. So bladder cancer has faced a number of shortages. We had a 5-FU shortage, which is we use for chemo radiation. We had BCG shortage for a long time. And now we have carbo and cisplatin shortage. You know, I think the sort of take home is global and pervasive across oncology. It's very hard to take a drug that you're used to giving that's a standard of care and figure out a workaround. I think, you know, different institutions are handling it differently. Most, I think, prioritize curative treatment if there's limited supply. I know there's some advocacy. There are letters by the FDA and the cancer letters talking about, you know, how to fix this, but it's a complex, deep-rooted problem. It's one we're going to continue to face. So we get over one shortage and then there's another one. And it's just a tough position to be in when we're used to at least being able to access the treatments that we want.
Although there has been a development, you were kind of referring to it earlier, that's very interesting that you don't see in lung cancer and GYN where we have these problems. And that's the approval of a new strategy. It doesn't involve platinum,
right?
And fortumab pembrolizumab. Yeah. We'll talk about that in a second. But I was just looking at the ASCO thing they sent out, and that's one of the things they have down there, metastatic disease. So we'll get to that. And that does bring up the topic of metastatic disease. So first of all, when you see a patient who has metastatic urothelial bladder cancer, how often are they presenting with it as opposed to they've had a cystectomy or local therapy and now they have a recurrence?
It's across the board. I think we see it at all different levels. I think we're fortunate to catch a lot of bladder cancer early. So typically they're patients who have known bladder cancer. We did our best to try to cure it and it's not cured. But some still have their bladder intact and we're managing the metastatic disease in addition to the disease in the bladder. So it's an even split.
When you do, and this comes up in breast cancer, when you do have a patient who's presenting with metastatic disease, how often do you still have to deal with the local issues that are occurring in the primary? And when you treat the entire body, does that usually deal with the primary as well?
Usually if the treatment works on the metastases, it works in the bladder, typically, not always, but you're always, facing the issue of progressive disease, which can progress in the bladder. It's a difficult area to measure, so we generally don't measure it as we're sort of measuring response, or certainly in clinical trials, it's not measurable disease, but it can be managed cystoscopically with TURBTs. We sometimes have our urologists, perform procedures to alleviate the tumor burden in the bladder, decrease bleeding. Occasionally, they require nephrostomy tubes if the tumor becomes obstructive and it's just easier to drain the urine out, tubes coming straight from the kidney. So we manage it differently. But in my experience, the bladder usually responds along with the rest of the disease.
And then in the patients who have metastatic disease are going to be treated with systemic therapy for the first time. And again, we'll start out with a younger or non-very elderly patient in generally good condition. How do you think through the type of therapy to deliver?
So we use cisplatin eligibility still to determine what treatment for patients. We think about two sort of pathways for patients. One is cisplatin or carboplatin-based chemotherapy followed by maintenance immunotherapy. And that's based off the Javelin trial, which did gem-cis or gem-carbo for 4 to 6 cycles followed by maintenance of Velumab. There was another HCRN study that had any type of chemotherapy with platinum in it, I think it required 3 cycles followed by pembrolizumab or placebo. Both were positive for progression-free survival. The Javelin trial had no crossover, so there's an overall survival benefit there compared to supportive care, really no treatment. And so that's one approach that we think about. When you're sitting with a patient in front of you, of course, you don't know if they're going to be a responder to the chemotherapy you're going to give them. They have a higher chance of responding if you give them dose-dense MVAC, almost as high if you give them gem-cis with cisplatin, and a lower chance of responding if you give gem-carbo. And we keep those statistics in mind when we start treatment for folks. We generally give 4 cycles of platinum-containing therapy. We don't go to 6 because in the retrospective evaluation of the JAVELIN study, there was no benefit to 4, 5, or 6 cycles. But they do need to achieve response to be candidates for immunotherapy in the maintenance setting. Once they're on single-agent immunotherapy, we use pembrolizumab here at Fox Chase based on the HCRN trial. Most folks will use avelumab every 2 weeks based on the phase 3 trial and the label. It can be very smooth sailing, right? It's intravenous therapy. In case of pembro, it's every 6 weeks. They come in for an infusion. If they have no side effects, which is the majority of patients, that can be the best potential outcome for those who respond.
Of course, people have a lot of experience with pembrolizumab and maybe less with avelumab. Anything different about giving that checkpoint inhibitor?
So the two things that stand out, the difference between the two, avelumab is every 2 weeks. In the clinical trials with avelumab, it was ongoing until progression or toxicity, so it could go on forever. And infusion reactions, rigors at the time of infusion are sort of a known hallmark of avelumab that we don't see as much with pembrolizumab. Pembrolizumab can be given every 6 weeks, and in nearly all the clinical trials I'm aware of, it stops at 2 years. That's felt to be enough treatment. And so there's an end point for pembrolizumab, at which point we feel patients probably don't need more of it. And that's nice to sort of have a goal in mind for folks. Those are the main differences.
So let's talk again about first-line therapy metastatic disease now in the older patient with comorbidities who's either not eligible for cisplatin or not eligible for cis or carbo. How do you think through therapy of patients like that?
Right. So I think in the past, we would have thought gem-carbo followed by maintenance, like we just said. But now we have enfortumab-vedotin with pembrolizumab FDA approved for this population of folks. And we've really shifted to an EV-pembro approach for a couple of reasons. One is this study was done in cisplatin-ineligible patients. So it's very specific to this population. So we can have confidence in terms of the safety data that we're looking at and the efficacy data. The response rate was 64%. Which is better than gem-carbo, even, you know, historically has ever shown to be. And we know that getting a response is required in order to benefit from any approach with immunotherapy, including maintenance. EV with pembro does have side effects. We haven't talked about EV yet, but it's basically a targeted antibody-drug conjugate. MMAE is the toxin conjugated to it, which is a taxane, essentially. And so the side effects of EV are similar to taxanes. The efficacy is better, but the side effects are similar. Hair loss, neuropathy, fatigue, the low counts, those things. So the EV pembro, you know, what's interesting, Neil, is you give it until toxicity or progression. And with EV, you hit usually toxicity in patients who are deep responders before a year. Very few people can really get it long-term beyond that because of the accumulation of the taxane toxicity. So what, you know, we're interested in looking at is, can we get away with less enfortumab? Perhaps can we stretch it out for longer? Can we stop it sooner in the setting of response? Those are the unanswered questions that we have the luxury to ask with a novel combination that is just so effective.
So one interesting thing about this idea of using EV pembro, as you were alluding to, is you start right out with the checkpoint inhibitor right in the beginning. Whereas if you use the chemo followed by maintenance, first of all, they have to respond to the chemo, and then they're not getting the chemo until a little bit later. I know it seems kind of crazy, but we did a webinar last week on endometrial cancer where they were getting into this issue because they had 2 new trials using checkpoint inhibitors first line. Whereas in the past, they did it second line, and they had great responses, and people were saying, well, maybe in the long run it won't matter. And then, but the GYN people say, but yeah, you want to, quote, get your, quote, best drug in early. Mm-hmm. And I think what they were referring to is not necessarily that, you know, immunotherapy is better than chemo. But the one thing about checkpoint inhibitors specifically, and certainly you hear it a lot with lung cancer, and I'm going to ask you whether you see this with bladder cancer too, is sometimes you see people who do really well. And there's always this, you know, I don't know, this allure to immunotherapy because of that idea that maybe they're going to be in that small group of patients who are going to do well, maybe even for a long time. Certainly you hear that a lot in lung cancer, but is that true in urothelial bladder cancer? Do you see people with metastatic disease who have great responses to IOs and, you know, you're trying to decide 2 years later whether to keep it going?
So that's a complex question and one we think about a lot. And the answer is yes. I have a cohort of patients in my clinic who have completed their pembrolizumab. They are still in response. The scans don't show any active cancer, and they come scan after scan for good news. And that's something that was unheard of before immunotherapy came around. However, single agent immunotherapy is not the way to start anyone with urothelial cancer. We get relatively low response rates, around 30%. We get a lot of primary progression and rapid progression. And so we don't do it anymore. In fact, the label has changed. So it's really not about the best drug. It's about the best strategy. And so you want to start, in the case of urothelial cancer, you need something else to go with the immunotherapy. You need it to be either enfortum avidotin or priming the tumor in the patient with cisplatin, ideally based chemotherapy. And so, you know, that's the best strategy for long term. The goal is to eradicate the disease and give patients treatment-free survival, meaning we can complete their course of immune therapy, pause all treatment, and they're doing great. And we do see that for a subset of patients. But we also have to pay attention to all of our patients, right? So while a few people will have this amazing response, we know that most won't, and we have to take care of them too. And if we can't cure them, we want to give them the best quality of life for as long as possible. So we don't want to just, for instance, you could argue to just treat everyone with frontline immune therapy, knowing it won't work for the vast majority of people, but it might work for a few, and then they won't need chemo or anything like that. That's essentially sacrificing a lot of our population to a suboptimal therapy for them. So a lot of this is sort of going with the best, I see it as the best strategy to help the most patients. And I think those patients who are destined to have a beautiful response to immunotherapy are going to get there no matter when they get there. Checkpoint inhibitor. I guess you could argue if someone progresses right through their early chemotherapy and doesn't make it to checkpoint, I don't think those are the patients that checkpoint is going to provide these great outcomes for personally. But ultimately, with our current strategies, patients get their checkpoint and they get it in the right combination at the right time.
So you mentioned enfortumab vedotin, and I always refer to urothelial bladder cancer when we're doing programs and other cancers as such a great example of how antibody drug conjugates have come into oncology. We're seeing them in all parts of oncology. You know, first-line therapy, lymphomas now has an antibody drug conjugate, both Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin, and the list goes on and on. You have two antibody drug conjugates that are approved, enfortumab, also sacituzumab, govitecan. Also, a lot of people know from breast cancer where it's approved. Can you first talk about your vision of what an antibody drug conjugate is and how you explain to patients what it actually is?
Sure. So for patients, I call it targeted chemotherapy, that there's like a novel, you know, antibody that is targeted to the cancer that brings the chemo directly to the cancer where it's brought into the cell and is more effectively administered that way. I do kind of see it that way. Antibody drug conjugates, it's a really cool technology, but really it's dependent on the success of the target interaction, right? This sort of homing in part and the toxin that's tagged to the antibody. So I'm glad we can experiment with different versions of this. And I'm really glad bladder cancer has too. But essentially, it's targeted chemotherapy. And the side effects are similar to the chemotherapeutics that are, you know, in the payload.
And what are the targets with these two drugs, enfortumab and sacituzumab?
So enfortumab vedotin is Nectin-4, and sacituzumab govitecan is TROP-2, which is tagged to topotecan, and enfortumab is tagged to MMAE.
And then when you look at the, quote, payload, sort of the chemo that is being delivered, and of course there are a bunch of, I was talking about lymphoma, so, you know, you have brentuximab vedotin, the same sort of last name, so to speak.
Right.
What do you see based on sort of what the chemo is in the combination in terms of toxicity? For example, what's the toxicity profile that you see with enfortumab?
So with enfortumab, the toxicity profile we see is similar to a taxane. Hair loss, cytopenias, fatigue, overtime neuropathy. There are some new toxicities that we see with enfortumab. So glucose issues, rarely, but they can be severe glucose metabolism issues. And rash. especially when combined with pembrolizumab. That's the one place where there's really overlapping toxicity, and the rash can be extensive, can be dose limiting, and can require steroids or novel derm systemic therapeutics.
You know, actually, and if you think about it, you know, even though these are targeted agents, as you say, they're targeted, but they're delivering chemotherapy. So the idea of combining immune therapy and chemotherapy is something we hear a lot about. We do that all the time with lung cancer and a bunch of other cancers. I mentioned endometrial cancer is another example where maybe there's some kind of synergy there. What have we seen? You mentioned combining enfortumab with pembrolizumab, and now it's approved as first-line therapy if patients are not eligible for platinum. What is seen there in terms of efficacy? It looked like almost all these people responded.
So we were really pleasantly surprised with the early efficacy seen with EV Pembro. I mean, this was years ago. We saw the first hint of it. And I remember standing with a colleague at a meeting being like, do you think it's true? And we're both like, well, I hope it's true, but it seems too good to be true. So it's true. I mean, the larger studies have shown, you know, earlier the response rate was 73%. Now it's 64%. That's still very high for a cisplatin ineligible population whose option would be historically carbo. You know, carboplatin. So the efficacy of the combination, I think, surprised us. You bring up the fact that if we call EV targeted chemotherapy and we're combining immunotherapy, we've done that before. We've done that before in urothelial cancer with really non-impressive results. So lots of studies, many, many patients treated in randomized trials of chemo plus minus immunotherapy with really no additive benefit of the combination up front. Really, the sequential studies is what showed the best response. And there's a lot of hypothesis around that, but I think it just underscores the need to combine things, notice some observations, and follow those up with bigger studies.
So one of the interesting things about all these antibody drug conjugates being approved now in oncology is you're starting to see a bunch of ophthalmic issues.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that with the erdafitinib too, which is not an antibody drug conjugate.
Right.
But what do you specifically see with enfortumab vedotin in terms of the eye? And do these people need to be seen by an ophthalmologist?
So for enfortumab vedotin, in the studies, they did have opto follow-up, but we haven't really employed that, I would be honest, in clinical practice. We usually check for any issues with visual acuity, because truthfully, all the dose mods are based on that anyway, even after ophthalmologic exam. And with EV, we see more irritative symptoms, dry eye, itchy eye, that kind of thing. We treat that with topicals.
Right. Yeah, that's what I've heard. Also, and again, you see this with other, you know, again, brentuximab, you see peripheral neuropathy.
Mm-hmm.
What is the nature of the peripheral neuropathy that you see with enfortumab vedotin? When does it come on? What kind of symptoms do patients have? And what do you do about it?
So I think it's a standard neuropathy we saw before when we were using paclitaxel. It comes on, you know, sort of deeper into the treatment. Usually it's in patients who are responding because they're the ones you keep on treatment long enough to get it. And it's really tough to manage, Neil. Honestly, we have to hold dose, decrease dose, stretch it out. And we know that ultimately we're still delivering a toxin to the fine nerve fibers of the fingers and toes, and that that can, you know, over time accumulate. Again, I think I said we're looking at ways to give less EV. We're doing some investigator-initiated work here at Fox Chase. Dr. Gattaglia is leading that, trying to see if we can adjust the schedule and still maintain efficacy in patients who are responding to address that very reason, that there's no, you know, antidote to neuropathy that's effective and really is often just dose-limiting.
And as you say, you see this throughout oncology, certainly with the taxanes. Any complementary strategies that you find helpful? Gabapentin, acupuncture, anything?
No, I mean, we sometimes try those things because patients want to stay on the drug. We do find, though, that folks don't like to stop it and are willing to let their neuropathy progress. Sometimes they underreport it to us because they're so motivated to stay on a drug that's otherwise working for them.
What about sacituzumab? I know usually it's given after enfortumab. I guess it kind of came along a little bit later, so not quite as much data there. But, and again, certainly a lot of experience there with breast cancer. What do you see there in terms of tolerability or complications?
So I don't have as much clinical experience with sacituzumab. We did not have it here in trials at Fox Chase. And again, as you said, it's sort of later line in therapy. But by the time we get to it in our standard treatment paradigm that we just spoke to a moment ago, generally the marrow can be suppressed from prior EV or prior chemotherapy. Generally, patients can be recovering from toxicities of those treatments or have more advanced disease. So I think just the population that ends up getting Sacituzumab govitecan in the urothelial cancer world tends to be a little bit more challenging. We do see cytopenias that are dose limiting, requiring dose reductions and sort of extending the schedule. And GI toxicity is common as well. We're used to managing that, and we manage it the same way with sort of hydration, Imodium, those sorts of things. But ultimately, I think we probably reduce the dose quite a bit with this drug.
So I want to ask you about the other agent, erdafitinib, that's used. But one other thing I would just want to bring up, I was mentioning, you know, the ASCO guidelines that have been circulating now with the chemo shortage. And we were looking at the bladder ones the other day for first-line therapy, and they had, as an alternative, enfortumab pembro. And we were looking at it and going, well, you know, there's a higher response rate, at least indirectly, you know. And like, why? What about the younger people? Why aren't they getting it? And I know, I guess the trials haven't been done, but do you see maybe that happening? You know, and I guess you could all say almost a non-chemotherapy, first-line therapy of metastatic disease, or do you think we'll be with chemotherapy for a long time?
So I don't know. Again, I hesitate to call EV non-chemotherapy because the toxin is basically chemotherapy.
Right.
But yeah, there's no cisplatin in it. And certainly if there's a cis or carbo shortage, you could lean on that. I would say it's safer to swap out EV pembro, and one might do that anyway based on the FDA approval for cis-ineligible patients. I will say historically in the, you know, years that I've treated bladder cancer, we've sometimes hedged, you know, we get the creatinine clearance back if it's 50 to 60. Maybe we call that patient cis ineligible if you don't have any cisplatin to give them and you give them EV pembro. Whereas in the neoadjuvant setting where you're going for cure, you would certainly consider that patient cis eligible. So it's a little bit of a, in the eye of the beholder, sort of shifting definition. But so far, Dostensumvax still has returned the highest response rates, 72%. So it's, you know, if you can go that route, it probably is the most data-driven way to go is with cisplatin-based chemotherapy followed by maintenance checkpoint in cis-eligible patients.
Based on your clinical experience, I'm just kind of curious how you would compare, let's say, the first 2 months quality of life-wise of a cisplatin-based chemotherapy compared to EV pembro.
That's a really interesting question. I think it varies patient to patient. I have someone right now on EV pembro with no side effects. I just treated a neoadjuvant patient with Dostensumvax. He also had no side effects, and that's the outlier, not the standard. So it's so, you know, variable. I think, you know, no one cares that much about the short-term toxicity because you make it through. You really want the best efficacy at that point. Long-term toxicity becomes a bigger issue, so you're dealing with it for longer. So I would say we don't really think about, which is why I was, you know, had to think when you asked me the question, we don't really think about the trade-offs of short-term toxicity. We really think treat for efficacy and then manage for toxicity as we're going along. That would be how I would answer that.
Are there trials actually randomizing younger patients to cisplatin chemo versus something like EV pembro?
Ineligibility, the criteria are all more biologic, which is as it should be. So there are some younger patients who are cisplatin ineligible, although truthfully, yes, the older patients are the ones who are less eligible typically for cisplatin. But absolutely, there's extreme enthusiasm for EV pembro, and we're looking at it in a variety of settings, including cisplatin eligible.
So final thing I want to ask you about is erdafitinib. I mean, you guys have everything there, you know, every type of therapy available, it seems. I'm going to ask you about another one I just read about, but first let's talk about erdafitinib, what it is and in what situations you use it.
Sure. So erdafitinib is an FGFR inhibitor for urothelial cancer. It requires an FGFR alteration. So the main change in practice that erdafitinib has brought is that we sequence everybody pretty early in their metastatic course so that we know if erdafitinib is going to be an option for them down the road. Specific FGFR mutations qualify the patient for erdafitinib. It's an oral treatment, and it does have side effects. Some of the pronounced side effects are hyperphosphatemia, high phos. You have to manage that, watch it, dose adjust for it. Very common. These folks we do send for ophthalmologic exams monthly for central serous retinopathy, which can occur with the drug and can be dose limiting. And one of the tougher ones is skin toxicity with rash and paronychia, where you have irritation and infection of the nail beds and patients can lose their fingernails. So it's a tough drug to give. The dosing is a little cumbersome with the different strengths, but we end up dose reducing, I think, most patients. We often talk about, you know, in the patient who's had their immunotherapy and their platinum-based chemotherapy, do you go for EV or erdafitinib in the patient with the appropriate mutation for erdafitinib? And generally, my practice is to go with EV first. It seems more effective. It's a little bit more manageable in our hands in terms of side effects. And it seems to have, at least in my practice, some durable responses even after stopping therapy, which are nice to see. Erdafitinib requires more frequent dosing and is difficult to sort of achieve response after you have to stop it.
Anything else you want to say about this topic that we haven't talked about today? Anything that you're excited about for the future? Also, maybe you can kind of put in perspective where we are today compared to 5 or 10 years ago, because it wasn't that long ago that when we did programs, there wasn't that much to talk about. Now you can barely get through this topic in an hour. Can you kind of put things in perspective and where you see it heading?
I'm so glad you asked that. I feel so fortunate to have had a career in bladder cancer that spans the last decade and a half that it has, because as you said, we went from very limited options, very short prognosis, to the occasional, you know, very durable response, which we never saw before, and average overall, you know, median overall survival numbers and landmark overall survival numbers that we could never have dreamed of. So this is amazing. And I love that we're also now really thinking about how best to use these agents, right? It's not just which is better, but what sequence leads to the best response, what combination should, you know, sometimes we shouldn't combine them, sometimes we should. And so I do think the field is asking a lot of the right questions. I wish we didn't repeat the same study with every different immunotherapy. I think a lot of patients volunteer for these studies and with questions we could answer sort of more efficiently, but that's a pipe dream. I think that I'll always continue that way. And the one thing I'd love to say to your listeners is now that we have effective treatments for bladder cancer, even though our patients on average are older, each patient is an individual. Age is just a number. We should not be selecting therapy based on how old someone is. We have tools to use to see what they're eligible for. Cisplatin eligibility is the first one. We have frailty schedules to see, you know, frailty tools to see who can tolerate cisplatin and who can't, who can tolerate carboplatin and who can't. And I think it's really time for us to stop calling our patients old, sick, frail. Definitely time to start moving away from age thresholds for cisplatin. I know some places won't give it to anyone over 70 or over 80. We need to look at every patient as an individual and really take the sort of lessons learned from our geriatric oncology colleagues to bring to bear for our older patients.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Plimick, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for What I Tell My Patients.